the Super Bowl, a super spreader event. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the fallout from Super Bowl 55 in Tampa and what it means for the COVID crisis here in Florida. What did you think of those pictures of huge crowds in Ybor City partying maskless at the Super Bowl? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, WJCT's special programming this month celebrating the Black Church. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the pandemic. Yesterday, the state reported coronavirus cases increased by 5,737. We are closing in on 1.8 million cases since the pandemic began. Hospitalizations went down by just one, but deaths rose to a total now of 27,815 across Florida. Here's another number to throw at you. More than 2 million people have now been vaccinated against COVID-19, almost all of them age 65 or older. Now, as the case count and the death toll continue to rise, public health experts today say they're concerned about last weekend's Super Bowl in Tampa, that it could cause another spike in COVID cases. You might have seen the coverage of the streets of Tampa teeming with partiers into the wee hours of Monday, many of them ignoring the pleas from doctors to socially distance and to wear masks after the Buccaneers beat the Kansas City Chiefs in Super Bowl 55. So was the Super Bowl a super spreader? Dr. Mobeen Rathore is co-chair, Infection Prevention and Control Committee with Baptist Health. He's also chief of pediatric infectious diseases and immunology at Wolfson Children's Hospital. Always good to have you on the show, Dr. Rathore, as we talk about the COVID pandemic. Thanks once again for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me on.
Here's our question to callers. What are your concerns about the Super Bowl in Tampa spreading coronavirus? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. In a few minutes, we'll talk more about the vaccination rollout around the state, too. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. So, Dr. Rathore, the NFL made a big show out of socially distancing inside Raymond James Stadium for the big game. They limited capacity to about 22,000 people and then filled empty seats with cardboard cutouts of fans. At the same time, we saw tens of thousands of people partying throughout Tampa, particularly in Ybor City, before, during, and after the game. When you saw those images as an infectious disease expert, what was your reaction?
Well, Melissa, it was very concerning. NFL obviously did the right thing. I think Mayor of Tampa also made those pleas. It was really dreadful to see a lot of young people mostly, but some older people also partying, no social distancing, no mask. That's very concerning, because it is events like this that can serve as an epicenter for a super spreader. And I think it's also important. I think this is important that the people who are in leadership roles, people who are celebrities, they need to be modeling this. They need to be wearing masks. I think it is really very detrimental to the message when you see people who are influencers not following what every sane medical person, every sane person in authority who understands public health and epidemics is telling you. Wear the mask, keep social distancing. So it was very dreadful for me.
If people are outside and they're really packed into a space, but they're still outdoors, but not wearing masks, can you explain what the risk is in that kind of situation, as opposed to a bunch of people packed indoors?
Obviously, the risk is a lot more because there is less circulation. The risk is lesser, not zero, lesser if you're outdoor. But think about it. If you're facing one another, if you're shouting and screaming and, you know, all these secretions coming out and all that craziness, that increases the risk tremendously. The force of the aerosolization with shouting and screaming and all of that, that really overcomes any benefit you may have from being outside. And I think, as you said in your intro, that the NFL did social distancing, they required masks. But unfortunately, there were still even some of the key celebrities who walked into the stadium without a mask. You know, that's not responsible behavior.
Yeah. Well, the governor, Governor DeSantis, was seen watching the game without a mask. What about that?
Well, I think everybody, you know, especially our leaders, we look at our leaders to model them, to set an example. So everyone should wear a mask. You know, we are approaching 500,000 deaths in this country. Our, you know, the successes of age in this society, we have lost, which we had built over decades, we have lost in this last 12 months. We are pretty much going to very soon reach a time where we have more deaths from this pandemic than we had had in combat deaths in the First and Second World Wars. And I think, you know, we are a tremendous nation. We get together, we unite when we are fighting an enemy. Well, you know, but in this case, and just because you can't see the enemy does not mean that we don't, you know, get together and fight it to this enemy together. So I'm really frustrated by some of these things. You know, all we can do is educate people. I'm not, personally, I would beg people to do the right thing if I have to.
Yeah, you know, when we talk to doctors like you, we can hear the frustration in your voices. You're just so tired of repeating this message over and over, but we have to keep repeating it because we're not out of the woods yet, Dr. Rethor, even though, as I said, about 2 million people in Florida now have been vaccinated. What are your thoughts about the next wave of vaccinations that we should hopefully soon be seeing as the vaccination supply starts to be distributed at more spots around the state?
Yeah, well, $2 million is better than none and better than a million, but it's still a drop in the bucket. We need to immunize as many people as fast as we can. That's really our hope to stop this pandemic. If we don't get immunized, the virus will find people who are susceptible and will infect them. So we have to really double up on the effort. You know, it's really disheartening to see that, you know, we can send a man to the moon and a spaceship to Mars and Venus and all those places. We should be able to do this. This is not rocket science, as they say. Get the vaccines out there, get the syringes, and get it into people's arms. Yes, it requires some effort, but we have that. I mean, we have the best military in the world with the best logistics systems they have. We have private companies who know how to do logistics and all of that. I mean, I just can't understand why we cannot do this. This has to be, as I said, this has to be on war footing. This is killing more of our countrymen and countrywomen than anything in the past in just such a short period of time. So I think, yes, we need to get the vaccines out. We also need to be sure that people understand. You know, I hear all of these things, we don't know this about the vaccine, we don't know how safe it is. Well, there's no guarantee in life. I'm going to drive to work right after this call. I'm going to get in my car. I will wear a seatbelt with the hope that if I, God forbid, get into an accident, that will protect me and the airbag will deploy. So I think it's the same way, you know, your seatbelt is your vaccine, your airbag is your social masking, and your body, your structure of your car that protects you is your social distancing. Think of it in that manner. Everybody drives. If you can just think of it in that manner, how are we going to protect against this virus, I think you will cross many of the mental barriers that people have understanding this.
It's 549-2937. The Super Bowl, was it a super spreader event? And what are your questions about vaccinations? As we speak with infectious disease specialist Dr. Mobeen Rathor of Baptist Health and Wolfson's, 549-2937. Eric in Arlington. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm wondering if we're going about this vaccination process in the right way. And what I mean is that we're vaccinating 65 and over, which does mitigate deaths up front. Especially, and I do agree that the vaccinating the elderly in these home settings where a lot of the spread has taken place should be the number one priority. However, just saying 65 and over, I think, is a mistake. And the reason I say that is because the people that are spreading this disease, as you can see by these videos from the Super Bowl, are these, you know, 20 and 30-year-old people that are out partying and having a good time. So if you want to mitigate the spread, the best way to go about it is not to vaccinate people that are 65 and over because these people are responsible. They're not stupid like the 20-year-olds. They're going to wear masks. They're going to act responsibly. So they're going to mitigate the spread while they're waiting for their vaccine. And also, people that are 65 and older are not people that are generally really, really involved with transactions out in the community. They're more likely to stay at home and so on and so forth. So if we really want to get ahead of this, I think once we get the nursing homes vaccinated, the best thing to do would be to start vaccinating, like, and this seems counterintuitive, 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds, because these are the idiots, if you will, who are spreading the disease.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. That's not the first time we've heard that idea pointed out on this show. Of course, 20 and 30-year-olds don't vote as often as senior citizens, Dr. Rathore, which could be part of the governor's calculus, at least, to vaccinate seniors first.
Actually, Melissa, there's a scientific basis why the elderly are being immunized. This has been well studied. So
I know. I was being a little facetious there.
I know you are. But to Eric's question, I think that's something that I hope your listeners would pay attention to. You know, in infectious diseases, there's this concept of infection and concept of disease. And let me explain this in a way that most people experience it. When you get chickenpox, you get the chickenpox virus and you get the disease. And then the virus sits in your body, dormant, goes to sleep, and when you get older or you have some immunosuppression, you get shingles. Now, shingles is a disease, so you're already infected, but you have a disease that is shingles. The vaccine for shingles protects you against this disease, not the infection. Infection has already occurred. In the same manner, when you get what we know from the studies, and that's all we can base our decisions on, is that the vaccines that are currently available and are going to be available in the near future protect against disease, not infection. Now, they may protect against infection, but we don't have evidence to support that as of now. We will probably get it down the road. So that is the reason we have to immunize those who are at the highest risk of getting serious disease and die from it, get hospitalized, get in the ICU and die from it. So that's the main reason we are immunizing those who are highest risk, the elderly, the vulnerable, those who have underlying health conditions. So while Eric makes a very good point, in this vaccine it does not work in this way. In some of the other vaccines it does work in that manner, but unfortunately as of now we cannot say for this vaccine that it will work in that manner.
549-2937, Mark in St. Augustine. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. Your guest might have just kind of touched on this, but I was curious. So if I go out and I get the vaccination, or a 20-year-old does or a 65-year-old does, it protects me against COVID, but can I still be a carrier of it? And that's something I was kind of, I haven't paid enough attention recently to all this, and I was just hoping your guest might be able to explain if I can still be a carrier, or does it in fact die with me?
A lot have asked us that, Mark. Thank you for that. Dr. Rathore, that's a really common question we've been getting. Can you explain that for Mark?
Yes. Well, first of all, there is no carrier for coronavirus. So either you have infection or disease. There's no carrier, fortunately, that we know. So, yes, so if you get the coronavirus vaccine, what we know right now, and this may change as more data comes in, you can get the infection, but what the vaccine is known to do is it will protect you from getting the disease, from my previous explanation. So you get the infection, but you won't get the disease, or you will get a mild or moderate disease, so you won't be hospitalized, you won't get into the ICU, you won't get intubated, hopefully, and you will not die from it. So that's what the vaccine does. It protects you from serious illness and not necessarily from infection. So I think that's an important differentiation we need to make.
549-2937. What are your questions about vaccinations in Florida? We're also talking about any lingering after effects from the Super Bowl when it comes to the spread of coronavirus. Tracy is in Mandarin. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, good morning. My question is, somebody, senior citizen, got virus, got the first shot, then they got a call yesterday for the second shot, we ran out, and then their second question was, first time we got Moderna, second time can we get Pfizer vaccine? Thank you so much, I will take myself off the air.
Okay, alrighty, Dr. Rathore.
Yeah, I didn't hear the complete question, Melissa, sorry.
Could you talk a little bit about the differences between the vaccination products?
The two vaccination products?
Yeah, and the ones that are coming, too, like the Johnson & Johnson.
So these are various types of vaccines. The two vaccines that are available right now are different from the Johnson & Johnson and from AstraZeneca vaccine. If the question is, Can you interchange the vaccine? Was that the question?
Yeah, I think she was wondering, like, if she got the Pfizer for the first shot, could she take the Moderna for the second?
Yeah.
You can do that.
Okay, that's what I thought. Interchangeability, there are no data for interchangeability for the current two vaccines, or for any vaccines for that matter. So what we are, what CDC is recommending is that try to get the same vaccine. If you got Pfizer first, get Pfizer second. But in case you get Pfizer first and you get Moderna second or vice versa, then you don't need a third dose to make sure you have two vaccines of the same type. That's what is being recommended right now. But I think every effort should be made to get the same vaccine because there are no data on interchangeability. It is going to be even more different with the other vaccines who are on a totally different platform. And some of this information is going to, you know, come out by research or what happens in the real world as data are gathered by CDC on people who are being immunized. Because, you know, they have the system called VSafe. You can sign up for that. And, you know, this all is going to be reported to Florida Sharks. So we're going to learn a lot about it. But as of now, there are no data for interchangeability. But if you get one type of vaccine first time and a different second time, you don't need a third dose.
Ray is in St. Augustine. Hi, Ray. How are you? Go ahead. Hi, Ray. What are your thoughts?
Go ahead. Yes, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, there's been a small study in South Africa that indicates the new variant of the COVID virus will sometimes reinfect people that have had a previous infection by the older variant of the COVID virus. So it may be that you need some sort of a vaccine to protect you against that. In other words, the different variants may require different vaccines. And so one of the vaccines that's commonly available in South Africa doesn't protect well against a new variant. So one wonders, with the vaccine not being as effective, whether or not we might just be into a situation like with a flu vaccine where we have to get a new vaccine every year.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that the COVID virus can be infecting in animals, it could be passed back and forth. So the question is whether or not you can ever really eliminate it, or is it just something we're going to have to live with from now on out and maybe get even an annual vaccination. That's all. Thanks.
Thanks, Ray. Yeah, Dr. Rathore, I think a lot of people are wondering that. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is this something we'll have to be vaccinated for every year? And also, what about these new variants? Those are causing a fair bit of alarm.
Yeah, the study that the gentleman mentioned, yes, the vaccine trial in South Africa showed that the vaccine was less effective, less efficacious against the variant. And, you know, this is not a total surprise. Viruses mutate all the time, and when they mutate, they change. We have known this with influenza vaccine for however long. And so there is a possibility that we're going to need a vaccine every year. It may also be possibility that, you know, if the variant becomes predominant, that we may need a vaccine. Those of us, like myself, who've gotten the two shots, may need a third one of slightly different vaccine. All of that is being studied right now. So what I would say is, right now, we only 500, I think last I heard, only 500 cases of the variant have been identified or confirmed in the United States. I think your best bet is still to get the vaccine. And think of it in another way. For the virus to mutate, it has to replicate. If there are people who are protected against the virus and the virus does not get the chance to replicate, then you're making it harder for the virus to become a variant. Now, that's not a perfect science, doesn't happen 100% of the time, but it makes it certainly harder for the virus. So I think, as of now, your best tool in your toolkit is to get the vaccine so you can protect yourself against the coronavirus infection and disease.
All right. Russell in Mandarin. Hi, Russell. Good morning. Hi, Russell. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You had a caller who, I don't know if he was being sarcastic or what, but vaccinating young people rather than older people who are more susceptible to serious cases of the disease and their rate of death is much higher than young people. You know, vaccinating young people, it would be vaccinating them to protect them from themselves, which seems a little wasteful of good, you know, vaccinations. They should go to people who really need them. The one real mistake that the governor is doing is he's not vaccinating teachers, but he's demanding that they go back to the classroom. That is an issue that should be dealt with. I went off point there a little bit, but My neighbor and his wife and his two children have held super spreader events right through this this problem, this pandemic. And 3 months ago, they and 22 of their cousins went to a wedding in California, came back, and every one of them came down with the disease. They were quarantined in their house. I didn't see cars move from their driveway for like 3 weeks. And I thought, okay, finally, they got it. And that's exactly what happened. They came down with the disease, all four of them, and all 22 of their cousins who went to that wedding. And, of course, they brought it back to Florida and, you know, spread it around to other people. But his attitude was, it wasn't that bad. I've had hangovers that were worse than this. Now, with attitudes like this, what do you do with a population who is just irresponsible and a governor who's irresponsible? That's all I have to say.
Okay, thanks, Russell. You know, Dr. Rathor, there is so much frustration about that in this region of the state. We hear it every day. People are just frustrated that their neighbors, people they see in stores, are not taking this seriously.
Yeah, and I don't know. As I said, Melissa, earlier, I don't know what we can do. I mean, if somebody told me that half a million Americans have been killed by something or someone or some group or some country, we would be, you know, jumping up and down and asking for some action. And here we have a way we can protect ourselves, mask yourself, social distance, you know, smart isolation, get the vaccine. It seems like it's not hitting home. And, you know, I'm sure you know people. Two of my classmates have died from this disease. And so to me, it's not only a professional thing, it's also a very personal thing. And I think it's important that we continue this. We cannot let up. Yes, we have to keep on saying that people seem to be getting tired of saying it, but we don't have an option. It's not like we can say, okay, let happen what happened. You know, I have children, younger children, who are not going to be able to get the vaccine for a while. I have, nephews and nieces, and, you know, I have friends younger. I think we have to look out for everyone. We have to keep trying this. And this is exactly what you're doing right now, Melissa, and you've been doing it all along. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Educating people, reinforcing the message. I don't know if we have another choice. I don't think so. I think, but if our leadership, our celebrities, you know, if they set the right tone, the right role modeling, it could make a huge difference. People are going to listen much more to Tom Brady after he wins the Super Bowl than Dean Raffer yelling at the top of his voice.
They're going to listen to him more than anyone here in Jacksonville like me. It really is frustrating to be giving these same messages every day on the air. And yeah, you're right, Dr. Rathor. We can't say it enough, but it's frustrating that more people aren't listening. We have so many calls from St. Augustine today. Let's go to Toby in St. Augustine. Hi, Toby. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. This is just an advocation for a little bit more nuance in the choice of who gets the vaccine. I'm 65. I've had the first one, and I'll be getting my second vaccine on Thursday. But I have a younger brother who's, I think he's 60, and he's had three heart attacks. I'm in great health. He's had three heart attacks. He's the one who needs a vaccine. You know, I'd love to be able to give him mine. But, you know, just advocating for a little more nuance.
I gotcha. Thanks for that, Toby. Lots of comments on Facebook, too. Here's just one from a listener. Please point out Lynch's had a packed house with a band and no masks over the Super Bowl weekend, while those of us still distancing are waiting on vaccines so we can see our families. And we are watching the selfishness continue to unfold. Dr. Rathor, what's your final message to everyone? There you go, Dr. Rathor. Sorry, I put you on hold accidentally. Go ahead.
I was going to answer your question about the fact that the younger brother had three heart attacks. That's the next group. So, Russell, you're going to have your brother should be able to get the vaccine. The vaccine that is just come being delivered right now to the health systems, is they are now recommending that it be given to those who are at vulnerable, less than 65 years of age, who are vulnerable and at increased risk. So certainly Russell's younger brother would be in that group. And so he need to contact what healthcare system. I know about what Baptist Health is doing. We are providing that to our in this limited supply, so we're going to provide to the highest risk in the health system there. I'm sure other health systems are doing the same or similar thing.
Thank you, Dr. Mobeen Rathore with Baptist and Wolfson's. Always great to get your insights. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You too. Much more coming up. Meanwhile, later, why pandemic fatigue is bringing down our contributor, Mike Favo. But up next.
The program is geared around the oldest historically black college in the state by bringing restoration to that university. We can't do that without also bringing some type of restoration to the community that it surrounds.
Building up the neighborhood around Edward Waters College. We'll go inside Operation Tiger Paw. That's next. It's called Operation Tiger Paw, a new initiative taking place during this Black History Month to restore pride around Edward Waters College. With more, I spoke with Tony Brown of the Jacksonville NAACP. Hey, Tony, thanks so much for being with us. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the Operation Tiger Paw initiative that's going on in and around Edward Waters College.
Certainly. Operation Tiger Paw is a brainchild that Denise Cook and myself came up with. We are members of the NAACP. I'm on the executive committee. I'm also the co-chair of the economic committee. What we wanted to do in light of, you know, all the protests that was going on, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, so forth and so on, as we looked in the community and we thought to ourselves, you know, once the statue is pulled down and once the protesting is over, these communities are still left in tatters. So the program is geared around the oldest historically black college in the state. It is a private institution. It was established in 1866. And we feel that by bringing restoration to that university, we can't do that without bringing some type of restoration to the community that it surrounds. You know, the college students need an opportunity to be able to walk out and feel safe and have something to do, as well as the residents there need things to be eliminated, like food deserts, better food, an opportunity to drive on safer roads, and just have a better quality of life that is in comparison with other places in the city. Not only that, but our passion is to also use the university as a place to have skills training, also to possibly down the road be able to facilitate sporting events like the Reins and Reebok game, make that a week-long classic, bring revenue, and also bring profile. We believe by elevating the profile of this community, in turn, we will elevate the profile of the city. With billboards and tiger paws on the street, so forth and so on, people will feel like they're in a real college environment, and the residents around will feel proud as well. So that is our passion, and that's what we're charged to do.
Now, you're going to be doing some canvassing on the 13th. And
Correct. You're
trying to get the neighborhood and business leaders, political leaders, everybody to buy into this. What's going to be happening on the 13th?
On the 13th, it is going to be a kind of a trial run. Myself and Denise Cook, we've been canvassing now for about 2 months on our own. And what we wanted to do is not only get a buy-in from the business community as well as the residents and the student body and the administration, we want to put a name to the face of the people who are going to be championing the cause for that community. We also want them to be able to feel comfortable with interacting with us. And we also want to be able to stand out in the community as people who are really concerned, who are not fly-by-night, and who are going to be consistently doing this for a while until we see real tangible change. It won't be a long walk. It just probably will be a block, depending on how many people show up. We do have some flexibility. It's supposed to only be 2 hours long. However, for those who have questions and for those who want to walk around a little bit more, of course, in twos, we encourage that, but we also are respectful of people's time, so we don't want to stay out there too long, particularly on a Saturday morning. But that is the reason for the canvassing. We're just going to be walking around, interacting, letting people know we are concerned for that community, and any questions that they have for us, we definitely want to take it back to the people that represent this community and really improve the infrastructure, if you will.
Yeah. The new stadium, that's a focal point mm-hmm. people can rally around. How hopeful are you that that can provide some momentum?
Well, very hopeful. I think the stadium itself symbolically represents something new. I think it is also indicative of where the college is going, particularly the dormitories as well as the stadium. Like I said before, I also feel like it could be used for certain events in terms of fundraising, in terms of bringing more exposure. And one of my ideas is to actually have a jamboree on television there. Because there is field turf, for those who are not really familiar with the surface that some of the football players play on, field turf is a lot more TV friendly. And not only that, but you can have multiple games in one day as opposed to grass where you can only have one game that day and then it has to be restored for another game for another week. So there's a lot of different things you could do with the stadium. And I know I'm excited, and most certainly the student body and the administration at Edward Waters is most certainly excited as well.
And then going beyond that, you want to put up Entering Tiger Country billboards on I-95, paint some tiger paws on the streets, get some infrastructure and beautification improvements around the campus, do some work on campus in the student center. This is all, this whole initiative will cost millions. So you're fundraising mm-hmm. too, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, before we can even get to that part, we have broken it down into three phases. The first phase is more of a beautification, things that we can do right now in terms of, you know, repaving the street, providing more lighting, you know, cutting down some of the brush, putting bumpers on the road. What we found, though, is for as many residents that occupy that area and as many students are there, you know, to have the cars going as fast as they are, is a hazard, and we want to try to see if we can kind of eliminate that. So that would be phase one. Phase two is more of the developmental stage in terms of maybe providing housing for the college students so they have a reason to stay and not leave the city. You know, we're having an issue here in Jacksonville where we're having a lot of brain drain and a lot of intellectual property and capital are leaving. Mm-hmm. And so our thought process is, if they own a home and that home has been refurbished and they have some skin in the game, so to speak, they're least likely to leave and they're more likely to invest in the community that they've been getting an education in for about 4 or 5 years. And then the last phase is the construction phase in terms of millions of dollars that we talked about before, in terms of creating a new student center that's very open to the residents and to the university in terms of a maybe a eatery, a Chick-fil-A, a room in which you can show all the history from 1866 into the present day, and also a room where donors and other folks can come in, and a conference room that's beautifully laid out that could talk about the future of that campus. And I think all of that needs to be on what we call the porch of the campus, which is the student center.
This is an ambitious effort, and in the mean, while you get it going, look for the canvassers on the 13th in the EWC neighborhood. Tony Brown, Jacksonville NAACP. Absolutely. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Look forward to seeing everybody out on February 13th.
All right, right now we're opening up a perfect read for your February. My Antonia by Willa Cather is a nostalgic and yet real love letter to America, written with clarity and precision by the Pulitzer Prize winner. Our book club leader, Stacey Goldring, is leading a virtual discussion of My Antonia next week. We've got a preview right now. Hey, Stacey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
I love Willa Cather's writing, and I'm glad you chose My Antonia for your book club selection for this month. Tell us about this book.
You know, this is the perfect month for February. It is a book that's basically, like you said in your opening, it is a love letter to America. It is told through the narrator, who is our Jim Burton, who is going back to Nebraska to visit his roots after a very successful career as a lawyer. But he's looking back on his life, his bittersweet memories of childhood with someone very special in his life named Antonia. And she really represents the growth, the growing pains, and the tenacity of our country's ethos, what makes us so special. This happens in the Nebraska plains in the late 1800s, with, you know, Laura Ingalls Wilder, sod houses, the Norwegians, the Swedes, the Bohemians, the Hungarians, all coming out, you know, with the promise of the Homestead Act to start life again in America. And Cather has, you know, Melissa, it's harder to write in less words than it is to use more words. It's much more difficult to speak succinctly and with less verbiage than to go on and on and on and on and on. And what Willa Cather does with clarity and exquisite precision is present the myth of what we think America is and was, and the reality of what America is. You know, there's always good and bad. And this is really about we as Americans, we who all are immigrants, who come together to forge a better future. It's such a beautiful book. It really addresses our spirit as Americans.
And some relevant themes. Now, if people go to your website, chapterendnotes.com, they can join in this discussion of My Antonia. It's 1 week from today, February 16th, 7 o'clock. And then again, the next day at noon, you'll do another one. Now, let me talk a little bit about your other big initiative, Litter Archer, a series you're doing virtually at the Kummer Museum. What's happening with that?
So Literature is a series that I do with art historian and lecturer Cindy Edelman. And we discuss how art and literature can bring us together and be a place where we can have civil discourse. We can discuss universal themes of what we all have in common using the vehicles of books and art. So for this season, Literature is focused on coping with COVID. And through that, we have selected, we have four different programs coming up. But our first one is February 24th, and you can go to the Kummer website to sign up. And it is called Running for Cover. And we explore Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Henry Fuseli's The Nightmare in order to give context to what I would basically call our shambolic last year or so. And it gives us a new perspective as we go into the new year. And, you know, we can really learn a lot about truths, about who we are, by looking at literature, and I think by exploring Frankenstein, which is totally overlooked because people just think about the film, but to really explore the beauty of this novel, I think it would be inspiring to those of us who, you've said throughout the program, you know, we're getting COVID fatigue, we're exhausted, some of us are feeling hopeless, it's just so frustrating with the misinformation. Well, I invite you to take a journey with Victor Frankenstein and with Henry Fuseli to truly understand their expressions of frustration and fatigue at what was going on while they were writing and they were painting. This is universal.
Do you think the pandemic has given people the chance to sort of get reacquainted with just reading, just taking the time to sit down and read?
I think the pandemic in a way has... when we could, again, focus on reading, because remember at the beginning of this, people were saying, I can't focus. I can't read. I can't do it. I'm just like, I'm so scattered. But I think what's happening is we are revealing what heals us in our choice of what we're choosing to read. So if you look back on what you've checked out from the library or bought from the bookstore in the past 12 months, I think you will have insight to who you are. For me, it's been British literature. I have just found solace going back to the wonderful authors of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. I don't know why, that's just who I am. For other people, it could be self-help. It could be, chick lit. It could be sci-fi. Whatever it is, I think it's interesting. If you look back and think, what have I read? It's going to say a lot about who you are and how literature can heal.
Mm. Here's an email from Martha. My Antonia is a wonderful book. Thanks so much for talking about it. Will Literature at the Comer be on Zoom? I think the answer is yes.
Yes, it will. We wanted to do a hybrid program. It just wasn't possible, safety-wise, to meet in person at the beautiful Comer and do it online. So we're going virtual until it's safe again to meet up again at the Comer. But you know what's so great about My Antonia also? First of all, a lot of people think it's called My Antonia.
Yeah.
So there you go, right there is a little bit of interesting information. It is My Antonia. And a lot of people don't know about Willa Cather. She's another one of these female authors, these women authors, who kind of got brushed aside a little bit like Edith Wharton did, because right after they became popular, you know, everything comes in waves. All of a sudden, their work fell out of fashion.
And now, and again, they're recognized. Yes.
There you go.
It's chapterendnotes.com. Stacey Goldring leads our book club. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you. Thank you, Melissa.
A quick break, and still to come, contributor Mike Favo on shaking his pandemic blues, plus previewing The Black Church on WJCT Public Media. We'll be right back.
For the first time in history, the Senate will try a former president.
If the accused is no longer president, where is the constitutional power to impeach him?
Former President Trump committed, in the view of many, including myself, the gravest offense ever committed by a president.
Join us for live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial starting today from NPR News.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
How did Usain Bolt shatter the world record for the 100-meter dash? The same way we can be more productive at work. Practice, practice, practice. Stephen Kotler, Executive Director of the Flow Research Collective, joins us to talk about strategies for unlocking the potential of our minds and bodies. His book is called The Art of Impossible. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Americans didn't invent tipping, but its role in our economy goes way, way back.
Train companies hired tens of thousands of black men, had them work as porters on the trains for no wage, just to live off the tips of the white customers who were traveling.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the history of paying tips instead of wages, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
The second impeachment trial against former President Donald Trump is about to start in the Senate. Is this already a done deal?
I think it is constitutional, but, you know, my job is going to be to listen to both sides of this, evaluate the arguments, and make a decision.
I'm Jen White. As the trial gets underway, is it time to curb some of the power that comes with being president? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
I woke up the morning of February 1st, and I muttered to myself, thank goodness January 2021 is over. Yes, it was only 31 days earlier that I woke up and muttered to myself, thank goodness 2020 is over. January really did feel like the 2.0 version of last year's chaos. Not much changed. Trump signs are still in the yards of those that won't let it go. Whereas many of the Biden households put blue bulbs in their porch lamps to make sure everyone knew that they won't let it go either. Meanwhile, I have 10 pounds of quarantine weight that won't let me go. Reddit fans of GameStop are telling hedge funds where they need to go. Students say back to school is where they want to go. And the Silicon Valley told Parler they are definitely a no-go. Rioters are here, there, and everywhere with their noisy demands to be the only say-so. Tom Cruise is telling his movie crew it's because he says so. And my hair technician says my hair is now long enough that she can make it into an afro. My reply, I don't think so. 2021. I can't really tell yet, but I am sure it will be either a so-so year, a no-no year, or hopefully a go-go year. For me, I am planning for it to be a go-go year. And if go-go boots come back in style, I won't be complaining either. I am confident of this because I made sure my 2021 is a go-go year. For the first time ever, I made two New Year's resolutions that I not only like, but I am successfully holding to so far. My first, I am avoiding social media rabbit holes. Just because a subject comes up on my Google thread doesn't mean I should read it. So I've resolved not to. As a result, I have deliberately missed out on learning the five greatest movies that I must watch before it's too late. I don't know why Gene Simmons ripped up a Van Halen contract. Nor can I retell the 12 critical signs that a rabbit uses to beg for help. This resolution also means that I have no idea what WandaVision is. And I've missed out on the keto diet, the DASH diet, and the new gluten-free Oreo diet. Because I am on the social media light diet, and I feel great. My second resolution. I am back to planning adventures, places to go, friends to see, and laughter to enjoy. Right now, I am targeting a first-time ever visit to New Orleans with my wife, a family road trip over spring break, a golf outing in November with some lifelong friends, in addition to renewed trips to several states to see and hug loved ones after I have a vaccination. I realize I may not get to do all of these things, but I will look forward to doing them and will have wonderful memories of the ones that happen. I can't wait to go-go.
contributor Mike Favo. Finally, this hour, WJCT Public Media is celebrating the sights, sounds, and spirit of the Black Church in a televised documentary and a community conversation. Our own Cersei Lenoble is heading up this effort, and she's on the line. Hi, Cersei.
Hey, Melissa.
In the few minutes we have left, tell us about the documentary we're airing and how people can join in a community conversation.
Well, next week will be busy. Monday at 7 p.m. is our community conversation with local experts. We have Jeff Boddy, the Associate Director of Worship at Shiloh Church, Bishop Charles Eichenberger Sr. from Cathedral of Deliverance, and Ben Frazier from the Northside Coalition Jacksonville, all with Lynn Sherman, the Director of Social Responsibility and Community Engagement at Baptist Health, to talk about their experiences in the Black Church, their memories, what it was like for them, and what it means to them and to the community. And that's at 7 p.m. on Monday, and people can go to wjct.org/blackchurch to RSVP. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. on WJCT, Dr. Henry Louis Gates is presenting his four-hour documentary called The Black Church.
This is going to be an incredible presentation. Everybody needs to watch this on WJCT television. Dr. Gates does amazing work. And by the way, if you go to wjct.org/events and look for Black Church, you can even submit record a video about what your church in this community has meant to you. So that's another way people can participate, Cersei, in this discussion.
Absolutely. We want to hear the community's voices. We want to collect those and share them. And they can also, if they go to that website, can also just type in their story and send a picture if, you know, they don't have the capacity to upload it with a video or audio.
So many ways you can contribute to our Black Church initiative, Sights, Sounds, and Spirit of the Black Church, as we celebrate the importance of the Black Church in African-American communities this Black History Month, with the new documentary produced by Henry Louis Gates that you'll see on WJCT television, and a special virtual community event that you can watch and participate in next week. Go to wjct.org/events for that. Cersei Lenoble, thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow, everybody. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.